Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 28th of March. And David Brooks is our guest this hour of the program. David has a brand new book, which is already, and we have to ask him how it got there, number one on the New York Times bestseller list. It's The Social Animal, The Hidden Sources of Love, Character, and Achievement. And I think he has probably one of the best first sentences I ever read. Because how can you not read the second sentence and beyond? It starts, "This is the happiest story you've ever read." Isn't that good? David is the op-ed columnist for the New York Times. He's been a senior editor at the Weekly Standard, contributing editor at Newsweek and the Atlantic Monthly, and he is a weekly commentator on PBS NewsHour, the author of the bestseller Bobos in Paradise, The New Upper Class and How They Got There, and on Paradise Drive, How We Live Now and Always Have in the Future Tense. The book, his goals are to show us what the unconscious system looks like when it is flourishing. And he believes that, you know, we probably spend way too much time jumping through, as he says, 1,000 scholastic hoops. And yet, by far, the most important decisions that we make in our lives are who do we marry and whom we will befriend, what to love and what to despise, how to control impulses. And on these matters, our children are virtually on their own, and perhaps we are too, because we are looking at different things that we think are going to make us happy, and yet they don't. So he created these two major characters, Harold and Erica, and he uses these characters to show how life actually develops, how they met each other, what attracted them to each other, the kinds of jobs they had, the teachers who were important in their lives. David is our guest this hour, and we'll be welcoming phone calls for him. He is joining us by phone from Chicago. He's on a book tour right now. We also have an email address, which is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. David Brooks, hello. Thank you.
Oh, it's great to be with you.
Yeah, great to have you here. Isn't it funny to interview somebody and you're so familiar with their voice already? It's strange. You have the best line, though. The opening line in this book is absolutely wonderful. Did it take a long time to write that one, or did it just come to you? Because you got to read the book if you read that line.
I'll tell you the lowdown truth on that one.
Please.
I'm familiar with a novel by Ford Madox Ford called The Good Soldier, which starts out, "This is the saddest story you've ever read," or something like that. So I flipped it. And actually, I flipped it for a reason, because a lot of the novels, especially about American life, and a lot of the nonfiction, too, is about how miserable we all are and how all the problems we have. But, you know, if you actually ask people, how do you feel about your life, like 90% of people are satisfied with their jobs. A similar number are satisfied with their life, and maybe they're exaggerating a little for, you know, just they don't want to admit they've messed things up. But a lot of people are sort of happy. And yeah. So I wanted to describe an America and a world where, you know, some people are happy, and to try to figure out what are the qualities that actually lead to.
Are you a pretty happy guy?
I think I am. I think I'm reasonably temperamentally happy. I was also a big baseball fan as a kid, and my team, the New York Mets, won the World Series when I was 8. In a miracle fashion. And I think that confirmed the view that everything is going to turn out well.
Oh, my gosh. I come from my husband is a baseball reporter, and everybody in my family loves baseball. I'll tell him that story tonight. That's for sure.
My son is a big Packers fan, so he thinks the world
is he really?
Well.
How did that happen?
I don't know. He just fell in love. In fact, I'm in Chicago now, and the last time I was in Chicago, I was freezing my rear end off at the NFC Championship game rooting for the Packers. So.
Oh, my gosh.
So
what a great story.
When your team wins, it has a big effect on your whole moral outlook, maybe. I haven't really thought about that.
Oh, you know how to treat a son. You know, it's more than schools. It's the Packers. We know that here in Wisconsin.
Exactly.
It's our religion.
Exactly.
Yeah. You talk about, and I want your definition of this because I like this phrase, that we need to know people who are happy and probably successful have street smarts. My goodness, you never hear of people having street smarts to be successful, but we have to know how to read people's situations and ideas, and the characters, fictional characters in your book have these kinds of street smarts. What are they?
Yeah,
what does that mean?
One of the reasons I could do this book now is because scientists in all these spheres are actually looking at these traits And the ones we can count, we've looked at for a long time, things like IQ and that sort of thing. Those are the things we emphasize in grades. But now there's been just a ton of research that looks at processes which are like half emotional, half rational, half conscious, and half unconscious. And so some people have the ability to look down a scene and just pick out the patterns in it and see what's important. And so, for example, my newspaper did a great story about soldiers in Iraq who could look down a street and they could tell whether there was an IED planted there, a bomb. And when they asked the soldiers, how do you know? They said, I can't really tell you, but I just feel cold. I feel a coldness inside. And that's not something you're just born with. It comes from closely observing something for a long period of time, and you get a feel for it. And so some people have the ability and develop the ability to study things closely, and unconsciously they get a feel for how the world works, and they're able to pick out the patterns. They're able to know what will go together and what won't go together. And other people have the ability to read people that way. And so these are unconscious traits I'm trying to describe.
Mm-hmm. And yet we look at the world, most of us, and we are taught in a different world where we more highly value what? IQ?
Yeah, we
fill
value
in,
the things
in the blanks.
We can sort of count and measure. So it's really easy to give somebody an IQ test, and that's important. I don't want to underestimate that. And grades are important. But they're reasonably, you know, if you look at how people do at jobs, IQ explains about 25% of the variation in how people do at a job. So 75% is other stuff. And it's stuff like character. It's stuff like the ability to read people. One of the studies I cite at the University of Michigan, they took some people and put them in groups and gave some of the groups a math test to solve. And they gave them 10 minutes to do it, and they could do it easily. They gave other groups 30 minutes to solve the problems, but they had to communicate by email. And they could not solve the math problems. They broke apart because so much of our communication is by gesture, by intonation of voice, by all the things that aren't communicated in email. And that, if that's most of our communication, you've got to be able to read that stuff. And having the traits to read a mood, somebody else's mood, to take turns while talking to somebody else, not just dominate the conversation, those are traits not really related to IQ particularly, but they're really important.
Mm-hmm. And do they have ramifications for the political world, which you really cover? That's your day job. If we were more in tune with that other level, that other layer, the street smarts, et cetera, the character, would we govern differently? Would we treat each other differently?
Yeah, I think so. So, for example, I really got into this because I was covering education, and we've spent 30 years reforming education, and a lot of the reforms have been disappointed because we focused on bureaucratic boxes, sort of big schools, little schools, charters, vouchers, and generally they've produced disappointing results. And that's because we've skirted the core issue, which is the individual relationship between a teacher and a student. People learn from people they love. But at a congressional hearing or at a state hearing or at a school district board hearing, it's often sort of unacceptable to use the word love, and people think that's
right.
Squishy.
Right, yeah.
But it turns out a lot of the stuff we think are squishy and soft are actually hard and practical. And I think that's where the research leads us. So whether it's that or foreign affairs or anything, I think if we govern this way, we'd pay attention to relationships a lot more than economic incentives, or at least as much as.
Tell us a little bit about Harold and Erica, but I'm thinking about Harold's teacher, and it was a teacher he did indeed love. And she made a huge difference in the way that he learned and in who he was. It was just phenomenal.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to describe the research not just in the lab setting, but the way it would play out in concrete situations. So I created these two characters, and I basically just used them as examples to illustrate the research. And so there's one chapter where Harold is, you know, he's sort of a charming guy. He plays on the football team. He's socially very popular in high school. But he's not a great student. He has no interest in that stuff. But he meets a teacher, and she really clues into what he wants. And I try to demonstrate that what we learn from teachers is not the stuff in the curriculum. It's their way of being in the world. It's just the way they think. We sort of absorb that. And she detects that Harold wants glory, that he's really interested in recognition, what the Greeks called the thymotic urge. And the Greeks really understood this hunger for glory, for to be recognized and to be, you know, admired. And so she gave him some books on Greek history, and she taught him how to learn, how to master facts, how to play with facts, how to let your unconscious noodle around and build new relationships. And so it was through that relationship he got to see a deeper part of himself he really wasn't aware of. And it sort of changed his life. He spent his life chasing what was down there, at elements of himself he didn't really know about.
Mm-hmm. And she was the kind of teacher who didn't really hold fast to one point of view, right? She would go through, as you just said, she would, you know, muddle around and this, and maybe this isn't exactly true, and she was open to possibilities.
Yeah, we sometimes have the myth that teaching is like downloading information on a computer, that the students are just these blank slates, and you just pump information into them. But of course, the minds, and especially teenage minds, are extremely active, and they're like, one of the scientists described it as, imagine a blender with the lid off. Everything's just flying around in there. And so one of the things she does is she makes him learn facts, and you have to learn the facts if you're going to be imaginative and creative, because you see things differently. And so there's one study I describe about with chess grandmasters. They took a bunch of grandmasters, and they had them memorize a chessboard in 5 seconds. And then they gave chess novices the same chessboard and asked them to memorize it. And the grandmasters could memorize all the pieces on the board in 5 seconds, whereas the novices couldn't. And it was because the grandmasters saw the board differently. They didn't see pieces. They saw formations.
Hmm.
The difference between, say, knowing a story and trying to memorize individual letters in the story. And so you got to familiarize and memorize the facts in order to see the field. And she has him do that. But then she also has him write a journal, just pop whatever pops into his head. Because a lot of the things that occur to us, there are thoughts and epiphanies that come from somewhere down below in an area we really don't have access to. And a lot of our greatest ideas just come to us in the shower. They just pop out. And that's because while we're measuring facts and doing all that stuff, the unconscious mind is playing around, trying to make associations, trying to fit everything together. And when we have an epiphany, which scientists have studied a lot, different areas of the brain, different things light up. And it's really one of the most satisfying things that ever happened to us when you're trying to solve a problem and suddenly you just get it.
What's interesting to me, David, is when you talk about fitting everything together, that everything is so much, isn't it? Particularly when you get to be a little older. Just think of all the places you've been and the thoughts and the senses, all that you've taken in. It's millions of things, isn't it?
Right, and it's, you know, the mind is capable of holding incredible amounts of information. You know, there are 100 billion neurons in there, and they're capable, each neuron is capable of making thousands of connections.
Wow.
So we sort of have this image of ourselves as just this this story that goes through our mind. But so much is going down below. And so one of the statistics I used to just to try to illustrate that point is that the human mind can take in 12 million pieces of information, of which it can be consciously aware of 40. And so a lot of the stuff is being thought of down there, and some of the processes down below are not to be trusted. Sometimes things are dangerous, but you know, for example, we tend to divide people into tribes. But some of the things are really smart, and one of the funnier ones I came across: a Dutch scientist tried to analyze how people should make decisions in the most cognitively difficult tasks, and one of those tasks is buying furniture. It's really hard to go into a furniture store and imagine what a sofa is going to look like back in your house. And he said in those kinds of very demanding jobs, you shouldn't make a list pro and con because you won't be able to handle all the information. You should study it, let it sort of percolate in your mind for a few days, and then go with your intuition. And that's a better way to do that.
See, in my house, I let everybody do that for me. So I have my Aunt Margaret O'Leary's 100-year-old table in the dining room and her stand and bed in the bedrooms. They all did it for me. So now I get to carry them with me, and I don't have to make any of those choices.
Yeah, so another thing that mine does, it builds into physical things all these emotional associations.
Yes,
And
yes.
We notice this in kids. Somebody did a good study where they tried to replace, a kid had a stuffed bear and they tried to, say, give him an identical stuffed bear, the kids would not accept it because they have invested a soul into that bear, which they've imagined and created. And we do that with all the stuff, especially stuff that's old, that's been around and has associations with the people.
Mm-hmm. I was listening to NPR on the way to work this morning, and they were doing this fascinating little piece. I don't know if you heard it or not. the people who were in charge of admissions for Amherst College. And they had, it's very hard to get into, I guess. There are 1,000 openings for 8,000 students. And the process by which these people gathered seemed so incredibly random to me. I mean, they were valedictorians, you know, head of the football team, head of the chess club, head of this, head of that. But they had so many people like that that the quirky things were what they were looking for admission. And it made me think about your book and people going through 1,000 scholastic hoops to get into the right school, to get the perfect life, to meet the right person, to get the great job, to make a lot of money. And it might just all be a lot of hooey, you know? Some of it is just you got to be unique to be happy. You got to find your own particular path that might be kind of quirky.
Yeah, no, things like Amherst, they're in this weird situation where, like, everybody who applies there was valedictorian. they've got to find some other way. But I think that's generally true. You know, the things, and there's a big disjunction between the things school rewards and the things life rewards.
Yes.
So, for example, school wants you to be able to get A's across a range of subjects, math, science, English, history, art. They like straight-A students. But in life, you really only have to be good at one thing. And so if you're really passionate about one thing, and maybe in school you were passionate about one thing, and maybe it wasn't even on the curriculum, and then sort of sacrificed all the other stuff, you get punished at school, but you get rewarded in life.
I think that's very true. Were you a good student?
I was actually not. I did not graduate in the top third of my high school class.
Really?
Partly for this reason, that I'm being more autobiographical. But I loved history and English, and I really did not like foreign languages or math. And so I got a lot of A's and a lot of C minuses.
Huh. So that's the way to go. follow Mr. Brooks's road, and that's the way to go.
I wouldn't have got into college these days. It's sort of, I don't like our admission system particularly.
Right.
So I don't let my kids get away with what I did.
So let's talk about Harold and Erica for a moment, how they meet each other, and they're fictitious, we must tell people, but it's fascinating, the cues they were giving each other as they meet each other at the bookstore for the first time and how it is they decide, because it is a momentous decision, who you're going to spend your life with. That's a big thing in life.
Yeah, it's by far the most important decision. I often tell college students every course they take in college should be about how to make a marriage decision, because nothing else will matter so much. Of course, there are no college courses in that, but and so they meet because the romantic decision is like a lot of decisions we make. It's half logical and half enchanted. And so, for example, people tend to marry people with similar nose widths to their own, with similar eye distance to their own, because we have a bias toward marrying people who are similar to ourselves, and that's for very good reasons. We tend to marry people who have complementary immune systems, which we can tell by saliva and by smell. And that's so our kids will have better immune systems. So all that is, we don't really think about any of that stuff, but
no.
It has some logic to it. But the other thing that happens is once we fall in love, we sort of get enchanted and we imagine great glories in our partner that maybe they don't always exist. So Stendhal, the French writer, had a great phrase, crystallization, where he said when salt miners used to throw branches into their mine, and they'd come back weeks later, and the branches would be covered in these crystals that were shimmering and beautiful in the sunlight. He said that's what we do to our beloved. We imagine they possess all these glorious traits that really weld us to them. We want to be with them all the time. And so it's half logical and half sort of romantic. And that's the sort of evaluations we're making all the time when we meet someone.
And tell us about, because I found these fascinating, the cues they were giving each other. It makes you think that those first 2 hours are pretty darned important, even though you don't know they are. But you're doing all these things very much unconsciously, the way you move your body, the way you do with your hair, all of that.
Right. We read each other's gestures. And so women like men who do what they call, what scientists call, the anchoring gaze, which is a sort of a long, prolonged look. And women have various gestures. Some of the scientists, and these are more behavioral geneticists, point out that for animals and for humans, the exposure of the neck is a sign of sort of, I'm attracted to you, because you're more or less trusting the person by exposing a vulnerable part. And so people do that as much as animals do it. And then there are things that are specifically human. So, for example, we all have different sort of vocabulary levels. And in conversations, people are very quick to match their vocabulary levels one to another. So So if somebody has a huge vocabulary, speaking with someone with a small, if that person is sensitive, they'll limit their vocabulary to make it equal. And so partners are measuring each other's vocabulary levels silently while they're talking to each other without even really being aware of it.
And what about body types? Do women want, and you have interesting studies about how much more money men can make with each inch of height, women showing off their breasts by doing something with their hair and exposing their chests early in this mating thing?
Yeah, and this especially in mating, genes play a role here. And there are certain traits that are universal. All humans have it. So all men through all time like women with a 0.7 waist-to-hip ratio, where the waist is 0.7 of the hip width, because that is a sign of fertility. And so all paintings in all cultures, even if you go back to Rubens, they were chunkier than, say, Twiggy, but they had the same ratios.
Really?
And so that's just a trait. And women tend to prefer men who are slightly taller than themselves and who have as much status as they can get. And so one of the statistics I came across, a study that found on online dating sites, a guy who's 5'6" can get as many online date offers as a guy who's 6 foot, but he has to make $172,000 a year more.
Oh, unfair. Unfair. What about character?
Well, people do measure each other's character, and I guess especially women in this regard. One study that's been replicated many times is they have a moderately attractive guy, a woman, go up to guys in a college campus, and they ask the guys to sleep with them. And typically about 75% of the guys will say yes immediately. Then they have a moderately attractive guy ask a bunch of women to sleep with him, and 0% say yes. Hmm. And the explanation, this is somewhat controversial, but the explanation that some scientists give is that in the Pleistocene era, women needed a guy who would stick around for a few years to help quarter while the baby was being raised. And so women are looking at for character, especially because they don't want a guy who'll just leave. And so there are sort of different screens we put up when measuring a mate.
And is this true of many, many cultures, or is this particularly true of America?
Well, there's some things that are universal, like a lot of these mating things are universal. But even so, even that, there are big cultural differences. There are some countries where we expect that we'll be in love with the person we marry. There are other cultures where that's not an expectation, and a high number of people, half the people, will say, no, that's not really necessary if I'm going to be married. It's more the whether our families get together or if the marriage is arranged. And so there, as well as some things that are genetic, there are vast cultural differences. And one of my favorites is somebody had the right idea to study people having coffee, to watch them having coffee at a small table in coffee shops. And they measured how often the people touched each other, just on the hand, just for emphasis or affection. And if I'm going to get the numbers slightly wrong, but I think in Rio it was 190 touches an hour. In Paris it was like 120. And in London it was basically zero touches an hour. So the British are more reticent, and so they're less likely to reach across the table and touch each other.
We need to pause, and we'll take some phone calls. David Brooks is our guest this hour, and his book is The Social Animal, The Hidden Sources of Love, Character, and Achievement. We're welcoming phone calls for him, 800-486-8655. He writes that we're living in the middle of a revolution in consciousness over the last few years. Geneticists, neuroscientists, psychologists, sociologists, economists, anthropologists have all made great strides in understanding the building blocks of human flourishing. We are not primarily the products of conscious thinking. We are primarily the products of thinking that happens below the level of awareness. And he incorporates information about all of these studies that have been done in terms of telling us the story of two fictional characters, Harold and Erica, from the time they – well, it's actually before that, because we learn a bit about their parents. But from the time they meet each other and get married to the time that Harold dies. Here's our number. Did I give it to you? 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@WPR.org. talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And because opening day is not very far away, we are going to talk about baseball tomorrow on the program. Larry Baldassaro will join us. Larry is an interesting guy. He teaches Italian and heads the honor program at UWM. He also was a semi-pro baseball player, and he's written all kinds of books about baseball. The latest book is Beyond DiMaggio, Italian Americans in Baseball. He tells the stories of Italian Americans' contributions to the game. Joe DiMaggio, of course, Bart Giamatti, who served as the commissioner of baseball, and others. But we'll broaden the conversation a little bit and talk about how different waves of immigrants have come into the field of baseball, so that it was probably ahead of its time when African Americans went into the game. Or how about when Jewish people went into the game, or Irish people, or Japanese people? It tells the immigrant story in some ways. Here, we've got to be public radio-ish about this and not just talk about who hit what and how we remember that moment, although that certainly is a part of baseball as well. So Larry's a great guy. He'll be with us tomorrow to talk about that. We welcome phone calls. David Brooks is our guest this hour, 800-486-8655. Kit in Shorewood is our first caller. Hi, Kit.
Hi, Kathleen. I am just giddy with excitement that I'm on the air with David Brooks.
Thank you.
Mr. Brooks, my husband and I are huge fans of yours. We watch you every week with Mark Shields. You're the guys to us. And we actually went to Elmhurst College to hear you present at the Niebuhr Conference and enjoyed it very much. So this is quite an honor.
Thank you. That was a great conference on one of my favorite theologians for people, a guy named Reinhold Niebuhr, who went to Elmhurst College.
Right, and we really enjoyed it. Anyway, here's my question. I'm very excited to read your book, except I gave up reading for Lent, which is a real sacrifice. So I'm going to have to wait a few weeks.
Did you really give up reading for Lent?
Yes, I never do something like this. It was crazy. It's a horrible sacrifice.
Kit, yeah. Can't you, you should change in mid-course.
Right. So, anyway, my question is, you see Mr. Brooks like a very logical and rational kind of guy. So I wonder if you were skeptical when you started looking at the research that showed the importance of intuition and kind of the subconscious in, you know, decision making and that sort of thing. And if you were skeptical, what was it about it that was most persuasive to you?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. I'm not naturally a touchy-feely kind of guy. My wife's joke is that me writing a book about emotion is like Gandhi writing about gluttony. Not my natural thing. And I remain not that great at expressing emotion. But the evidence just led you there. And a lot of it was, you know, high school dropouts. Why did, you know, 20 or 30% of kids drop out of high school? And when you get into that, the research on that, it's what the economists call non-cognitive traits. And meaning not IQ. And a lot of it is influenced by the first few years of life. Do kids at age 18 months know how to build relationships with other people? Do they at 4 years of age learn how to control impulses? And so the research just took me in this direction. And then the other thing that's happening is that we're in this change in the way the researchers look at emotion. And there's a great scientist named Antonio DiMaggio at USC. And he says in 1995, if you went to a big neuroscience convention, there would be nobody. There were no panels on emotion, but now there are dozens and dozens of panels on it. So researchers are coming to see the central importance of emotion and intuition. And so I sort of followed them against my disposition, I guess.
Thank you so much, Kit, for your call. And I think you got to change what you're giving up for Lent. These first, and you write about these first couple of years of life, Harold, when we look at Harold, that when Harold was about 11 months old, his mother realized she knew him better than she'd ever known anybody, even though they never exchanged a word. And thanks to his mom's attunement, you write, he became confident that if he sent a signal to the world, it would be received, that children at 42 months, if you can look at them, they can you can predict with 77% accuracy who will graduate from high school.
Right, because some kids have established that ability to have a two-way relationship.
My.
And if you can do that when you go to school, you'll be able to do it with teacher. Then you got a big leg up. If you can't establish relationship, or if you just don't know how, don't have the models in your head, then it's going to be much harder. And so those early things are really important. Now, it's always worth emphasizing that nobody's life is determined at 18 months or 42 months. So these things open up pathways, and you can have later experiences. Say you have a very disorganized childhood or something doesn't go right for you. If you have a mentor in eighth grade or when you're 20 or when you're 40 or 60, that can all change. So we're not wired in, but we're on pathways.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Kit, so much for your call. Let's go to Bob in Madison. Hi, Bob. Hello, Bob.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Thanks a lot for the show. Sexuality and romance is always really interesting. I just wanted to comment real quickly. Studies of universal determinants of sexual desire are talked in a great deal in the academy. The thing is that for every one study which supports sort of universal claims, there's also one or two studies which dispute them. And so there's actually a large variation within the academy of who supports, for instance, the notion of universal hip to waist ratios. And I just wanted to mention that and ask David, does he attend to these controversies in his book? And I'm also curious, just as a journalist, how does a journalist decide when looking at academic research what sides to attend to and what not to attend to?
Right. That's also a very good question. So what I try to do is I play it safe. I try to play it as safe as possible. And so a lot of the stuff in the book, I don't really have that much cutting edge stuff because that stuff is more likely to be invalidated by subsequent experiments. Nonetheless, even if you try to play it safe and you try to just emphasize the studies that are in the middle of the field, many fields are hotly disputed. And the one you described, the 0.7 waist-to-hip ratio, that is disputed. And in that case, I tried to go with the majority. I also, frankly, looked at the various reasoning on both sides. And I guess in that case, I just had to make a call. And I thought the people who say there are these ratios, who are mostly behavioral geneticists, they seem to me more persuasive. So one of the problems with writing this kind of book is that you're trying to give people a sense of where the field is. But, of course, each field is a discussion or an argument. And sometimes you can't capture all the different fields in the argument. So basically you try to play it safe, but some things are going to be corrected. Like anytime you write about science or anything, some of the things that seem true now are going to seem untrue in 5 years. And I guess that just goes with the nature of the field.
Mm. You write, David, that there's a debate in this country, in this culture, about what really makes us happy, summarized by, on the one hand, the book On the Road, and on the other, the movie It's a Wonderful Life, the former celebrating the life of freedom and adventure, the latter celebrating roots and connections. Research makes it clear that what the inner mind really wants is connection. Do we need both of those, particularly in this American society that values, you know, lots of experiences, independence, trying this, trying that, and then eventually we work into it, It's a Wonderful Life? Do we need both of those, or should our model be It's a Wonderful Life?
Well, I quote in the book a guy named Richard Ogle who has a great concept of reach and reciprocity, which reach is when you go out and discover new things, and then reciprocity is when you bring them back in. And so you got to establish rhythms of that. Nonetheless, I think here's an area where there's a mountain of research that basically the more close personal connections you have, the happier you're likely to be. Mm-hmm. The relationship between money and happiness, there's some relationship, but it's not a very strong one. And if you move from lower class to middle class, you'll be happier. But once you get at a certain level, more money doesn't necessarily give you a lot. But more connections definitely gives you a lot. So one of the ways one study put it is that joining a club that meets once a month produces the same happiness boost as doubling your income. And just, you know, your marriage, your friends, your connections, that stuff really is very important. So if you're just measuring the two different ways of living, sort of riding a motorcycle across the country with maximum individual freedom, that's probably not as good a bet for most people as being in a community, being active in community affairs, having dinner with friends. One of the other studies that I cite in the book They tried to look at the individual activities that contribute most and least to personal happiness. And the one of the things that does most is having dinner with friends. One of the activities that's most harmful is commuting, because we tend to do that alone over long distances.
Dinner with friends, nothing beats that. It's wonderful to have dinner with friends. Friends who like to talk.
Unless you cook like me. No, I'm just kidding.
All you need to do is master just a couple dishes, and then you serve them all the time.
Right.
That's it. That's all you have to do. Thanks, Bob, very much for your call. Let's go to Peter in Baraboo. Hi, Peter.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking the call. Mm-hmm. Both of you, I follow the shows religiously. David, I read your columns. I am a candidate for a school board in a small community here in Wisconsin, Baraboo. I have an ongoing debate going on with another member of the school board, as well as other constituencies, about the importance and the power of the kinds of issues which you have described in your columns and in your book for our children. Most people seem to feel that logic and the mind and reason are going to give us the answers which we need. And in my research and following many of the things which you've written about, David, including Christopher Shoblis and Daniel Simons, The Invisible Gorilla, Irrational Predictability by Dan Ariely and his work, and John Lehrer's book on how we decide, there is so much beneath the surface which we do not understand that drives us to make the decisions that we make, that it's important for us to help our children uncover, discover, and embrace those things so that in addition to logic and reason, they make decisions from the heart. When I used to teach literature, of course, we had Nathaniel Hawthorne's The Great Scarlet Letter of the debate of the heart and the mind. And I just wanted to thank you for all of the work that you have been doing to help people understand that the great answers of life come from that combination and not from one or the other.
Right. Yeah, no, I completely agree with that. And I found even talking about this book, people have these categories in their head that where they divide reason from emotion. They think it's like a seesaw. If you're being rational, then you're not being emotional. And if you're being emotional, you're not being rational. But what emotions do is they assign value to things. And they tell you what you want, what you don't want, what you admire, and what you don't. So if you can educate your emotions by reading books, by listening to music, by being around wise people, you'll widen your emotional repertoire of judgments and valuations, and that'll allow you to make wiser, more logical decisions. So emotion is the foundation of reason. It's not the opposite of reason. And you gotta emphasize both things.
Thank you, Peter, so much for the call. Here's an email that's come in from Mike in Hudson. I always enjoy your opinions, David. Your thinking seems much too nuanced for today's conservative conversation. I enjoyed watching William F. Buckley when I was a kid. While my views are mostly liberal, I'm always looking for today's reasonable conservative voice. It seems to be down to the two Davids, you, David, and David Frum. Where can I get some non-ranting conservative opinion?
Well, I go to online, and there's a magazine that comes out every month or every other month called National Affairs. I think that's an excellent magazine. It's on moral issues, public policy, a lot of different issues. That's one thing I would give a plug to read National Affairs magazine.
Let's go back to Harold and Erica. What were their, did they have political persuasions, and was it important in this match for them to politically see the world in the same way?
Yeah, I think we all know couples who are split left and right, and I guess mine is. So I think, you know, if you agree on the more foundational things, I think that's fine. But, generally, the more things you have in common, the more likely your marriage is to do well. We have this myth that opposites attract, but I think there's a mountain of research to suggest that sometimes opposites attract, but mostly we like people who live near us, who think like us, who have the same reactions to the same characters, who maybe before they met went to some of the same places, saw the same musical acts. And so, in general, those things are usually in common. And that points to a truth about politics, which is we have this image, at least in the hyper-rational explanation of things, that the way people form their political association is that they study the issues and look at the health care plans and the competing tax policies, and then they decide which party they're going to belong to. But very few people actually choose their party on that basis. They choose their party on the basis of social identity, which party seems to be filled with people more like themselves. And once, and there's research on this too, once they choose their party, then they develop the philosophies. And so, you know, I think our political party affiliation is part of the broader web of our identity.
Hmm. Jenny in Eau Claire. Hi, Jenny.
Hi. I have something to say that's very similar, I think, to a previous caller. I'm an English professor, and what you're talking about reminds me a bit of learning emotional intelligence. And it seems to me you had said that we don't have courses in college that teach that, but I really think that literature courses do teach that. I think that's a great place to go to, for instance, read Jane Austen, who talks a lot about what makes a good marriage, what kind of balancing, what do you have to do between love and the practical, for instance. So I just wanted your comment on that.
Yeah, I agree with that. When I was saying courses, there is no college course. There's no course that will say marriage. But if I were designing a course, say, on that subject, just to stay with that, I would certainly include, I would start with literature, and I might include some psychology. I might include some neuroscience on what a brain looks like when it's in love. I might include a lot of different things. But I would certainly include literature because you can study the brain, but there's no amount of brain research that'll help you explain Moby Dick or a Jane Austen novel. That's on an entirely different level, which can't be explained with neurons and synapses.
Get to the complexity.
Right. And one of the things we do is when we're around other people, and not only the people we meet, but also the characters we read about, we move with them and we share their emotions. And if somebody like Jane Austen is giving you a very subtle set of emotions, then you're absorbing them and you're learning. They become part of your toolkit. Hmm.
And who else do you think is particularly important beside Jane Austen, Jenny?
Well, for me, I can just speak personally that I think having read, for instance, Jane Eyre when I was young was very important to my sense of being an independent woman. So it's interesting, it was a 19th century novel, but it taught me what I needed to do to forge a self before I married. And, you know, that wasn't the only book I read like that, but I think the 19th century novel has a lot about morality in it. And I think of, for instance, Anthony Trollope. He wrote this novel called The Way We Live Now that basically reads like the financial collapse we just had, because he talks about the greed of what happens when we're all greedy. So I think we can learn, you know, just a lot from literature. And I it's sad to me in a way, because I feel like literature is moving to the margins of our college university curriculum.
Oh, that's terrible if that's the case. And yeah. David, what about you? What literature do you think that Harold and Erica would have shared?
Well, one of the things I wanted to mention was there are two different kinds of love. The one is the kind of love we experience in the first blush romance, and the next is what we experience through most of our lives, which is a less addictive but gentler but hopefully happier love. And there are very few writers who describe that kind of love, but one of the stories that does is a Tolstoy story, which is actually called Family Happiness, which is about couples in middle age, and he describes their emotions toward one another. So we tend to focus on the stories that, you know, are the Romeo and Juliet passions, but the quieter passions Tolstoy got at beautifully.
David Brooks is our guest this hour. His new book is The Social Animal, The Hidden Sources of Love, Character, and Achievement. Thank you, Jenny, so much for your call. We have one line open if you'd like to try us, 800-486-8655 is our number. Our email is talk@wpr.org. More calls in a moment. Oh, we do want to tell you, where's my note about that? I have always too many papers here. This is at 6 o'clock tonight on the Ideas Network. National Public Radio News will provide special coverage of President Obama's speech on the U.S. and NATO military operation in Libya. So that is tonight at 6 o'clock, and there will be analysis of the speech as well. Tonight at 6. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. David, here's an email that's coming in from Cherie in Fort Wing. She's wondering if you are going to record an audiobook of The Social Animal. She thinks that you have a wonderful speaking voice, and the book sounds very interesting.
Well, thank you for that. There is an audiobook, but this time they got a professional to do it. And I have, having done an audio version of my first book, I found it, A, really hard, and part because I realized how my book seemed really boring reading it over again. But also you realize how good the professionals are, and I'm a big consumer of audiobooks, and the professionals, just they're amazing at it. So there is an audiobook, but not by me.
Tim is our next caller from Fort Collins, Colorado. Hi, Tim.
Hi.
Hi.
My question was for David. I'd like to know how his research and writing of the book has changed him himself.
Yeah, I think I'm. I see the world very differently. So where I used to see the, you know, the surface conscious world as sort of the main determinants of life, I don't necessarily. And I now see all these unconscious and emotional currents that are flowing down below. So it's like being aware of a whole different layer of life. And so it's sort of subtly changed my viewpoints on everything from politics to personal stuff. I guess the interesting thing, in active full disclosure, I haven't turned into Mr. Perfect Touchy-Feely Guy yet. I still have trouble expressing some of the things I think and see. So I haven't become, like, the ideal person. But I think I see the world better, and maybe gradually over the years I'll maybe begin to express things better, too.
Maybe one of our callers gave up books for Lent. Maybe you need to give up talking for a week and see what happens, right?
You know, they have these. The scientists have great respect for meditation, and especially sometimes for the kind where you go to a place and you're silent for a week and just sort of observe what's happening in the inner mind. I'm still a little too repressed to do that, but maybe someday I should.
Yeah, I tried that once.
Can I make a comment on
that?
Yeah,
go ahead, Tim.
Yeah, I've actually saw a program somewhere on PBS on some fellows down in Georgia that were meditators, and they went into a prison and started a meditation program in the prison, and at some point they would take the prisoners that participated in it and put them into one of these week-long no-sound, just do and then meditate and do and then meditate programs at the prison. And they filmed the whole thing, and when the prisoners came out of this, there was like a guy that was the leader of one of the gangs in the prison, and you know, this was a pretty harsh prison down in southern Georgia, but the comments by the prisoners were amazing. One guy said, the gang leader, I distinctly remember saying, you know, if you sit there long enough, pretty soon all your crap is going to come up and look you in the face, and you can't get away from it. Isn't that amazing?
Huh. David.
Yeah, no, it's somebody compared it to, one of the scientists compared it to, our conscious mind is like a searchlight, and it can focus very tightly on the thing we focus our attention line on. But if you turn off that searchlight, it's like turning off a flashlight in the middle of the night. Your eyes adjust, and you see more dimly, but you see a whole landscape that maybe you didn't see when you had the flashlight on. And so a lot of what meditation does and that silence, it turns off the flashlight, and you become aware of a lot more stuff that's out there.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Tim, for your call. Barbara in Superior. Hi.
Well, hello. Thank you for the program. I'm a big fan of Lerner Report and public broadcasting. But, David, what inspired you to write this book? Thank you.
Thanks, Barbara.
Yeah, it started as, you know, covering politics, really, which is what I do in my day job. And we had so many, there were so many problems. I mentioned education, but other things like foreign affairs. And, you know, we went into Iraq not really aware of the psychological and cultural realities there. I covered the decline of the Soviet Union, and our experts on that were sometimes not aware of the psychological complexities of Russia. And so I was surrounded by a lot of issues, which we were messing up because we had an insufficient view of human nature. And here were these researchers giving, I think, a better view of human nature. So I just wanted to publicize and celebrate what they're coming up with and try to learn from it.
And we have time for one more call. Bob in West Dallas. Hi, Bob. You're the guy.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you. I enjoy your discussions very much on Friday nights. And I want to point out that I believe in any discussion with an opponent with an opposite point of view, you begin by pointing out areas of agreement before you launch into your rationale for an opposite point of view of the opponent. I think this is something that we could use here in Wisconsin at this time.
David.
Yeah, there do seem to be forces that pull people to opposing forces. And this is what I observe in Washington, at least, that we have a tendency to be tribal and to be team-oriented and then just to be 100% true to our team. And I do think that distorts things. And you don't need my view on what's going on in Wisconsin, but one of my premises is if we're going to cut budgets, which I do think we have to do, one of the premises should be that everybody has to take a hit, that the pain should be spread as widely as possible. I think that's, and that really comes out of the stuff in the book, that you have to pay attention to the social fabric.
Thank you, David, so much for being with us. I enjoyed the hour. Thanks.
Oh, thank you.
David Brooks, the book is The Social Animal, The Hidden Sources of Love, Character, and Achievement. It has just been published by Random House and is number one on the New York Times bestseller list. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing the hour and to Chrissy for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. Thanks for listening.